Hello, I'm Christine, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 6th of August 2025. Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacon. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition. Reading for you this week, we have myself, Christine, Ian, Angela, Helen, Mohammed, Mina, Simon and Roger. In this week's edition, we have all the latest from Beacon with Helen and Mohammed. You'll have to be sharp of mind as we have another challenging Did You Know feature from Roger and quiz with Mina. There sure has been a familiar feel to the weather of late. How long will this unsettled spell of showers last? Will the summer sun return? We hear from Mina, who has the forecast for the week ahead. From the latest events and tech trends to our trusty four-legged friends, we have all the latest news and information from the Black Country. A new pop-up community shop opened over the weekend in Wolverhampton, just in time to help families over the summer holidays. Caring Hearts in Ashmore Park already has a large shop full of pre-loved clothes, books, toys, and other small household items, and last Saturday it added a community shop. Neil Rutter, manager of Caring Hearts, is planning a permanent community shop at its Griffiths Drive site. But until that is built, he has created a pop-up in a mobile office unit. We really want to help our local community access great food at great prices, and working with the council, we've been able to open this pop-up shop just in time to help families over the long school summer holidays. It can be hard at the best of times keeping up with hungry children's appetites, but it's especially hard over the long holidays when everything has gone up so much over the last few years. So while we wait to develop our large permanent community shop on site, we thought let's open something now to help in any way we can. We have a large group of regular customers who come to the main shop for clothes, shoes, toys, and a host of other items, so they can now get their groceries at the same time, said Neil. All residents need to do is pick up a membership form, which is very easy to fill in, and pay an initial £5 fee to join, before getting on with their first shop. Councillor Stephen Simpkins, leader of the City of Wolverhampton Council, said it was great to see yet another shop opening in the city. I'm really proud of the community shop network we've been able to create in the city with our partners. Hard-working people like Neil and dedicated volunteers throughout our communities make these shops possible, and I applaud them for it. This is great timing, and I congratulate Caring Hearts for creating this pop-up now while they wait for the permanent shop. It shows how in tune they are with the people they serve and the understanding they have of how tough the summer holidays can be for some families. The council is committed to the future of community shops, as they really do offer a way for people to do the best for their families in these difficult times. They also help our local economy, which helps everyone in the city in the long term. This is just one of the many ways, as a council, we're trying to help our citizens deal with the ongoing challenges of the high cost of living. Food remains the number one item regarding cost of living with which residents need our help. It's the latest community shop to join the citywide network, which also includes the flagship Central Shop and Pomegranate Cafe at the Queen's Building in Victoria Square in the city centre. Shoppers can save a lot of money every week on groceries by using the community shops instead of major supermarkets. The council helped create the shops with an initial investment from the government's Household Support Fund and provides ongoing support, but they are run day to day by staff and volunteers at community centres and hubs like Caring Hearts. For more information and to sign up, drop in and see Neil and his team on Griffiths Drive next to St Albans Church. For more details on all cost of living support available from the council, check out the council webpages or contact them directly on 01902 551 1155. Pocket to Plate is another key project the council developed to help residents provide nutritious and tasty food for themselves and their families on a budget. Community chefs Prince and Simon join forces with self-taught cook and TikTok star Mitch Lane every Thursday to release new recipes and how to cook them as part of Pocket to Plate. Follow at Pocket to Plate now on Instagram, TikTok and YouTube to see great ideas for feeding the family. And hundreds of residents across the city have also benefited from free advice and support thanks to regular community events organised by City of Wolverhampton Council. Help at the Hub, run by officers from the Council's Public Protection Scams team, sees a wide variety of local organisations offer free advice, support and information to residents. The events, which take place every 2 months, are held at venues across the city. Since they began, more than 300 people have been supported with help and advice on everything from money matters and health to education and safety. The next Help at the Hub, to be held in Bilston on Tuesday the 19th of August, will be the 20th in the series. It will take place from 11am to 2pm in the main hall, Bilston People's Centre, XL Church, WV14 0LT. Residents can speak with advisers from Aquarius, Camp Hill Village Trust, Cuth, Neighbourhood Safety Coordinator, Public Protection, Send Offer, Seven Trent, Suit, Talking Therapies, Terrific for Twos, Waste Services, Welfare Rights, West Midlands Police, Wolverhampton City Credit Union and the Wolves Foundation. Officers from the Public Protection Scams team will be handing out free scams awareness and prevention packs. People are welcome to drop in and speak to any number of the organisations for free help and advice. Councillor Bhupinder Gakal, City of Wolverhampton Council's Cabinet Member for Resident Services, said, "Our Help at the Hub events have become a real fixture in the city's calendar, and they have helped so many of our residents. People have received support on a whole host of topics that may have been worrying them, such as housing advice and assistance, debt management and crime reporting, as well as support around health concerns and jobs. They have also received information about a wide range of other topics to help their loved ones, family, friends and neighbours. By going out into communities, we have been able to support those residents who don't regularly use computers or apps. It also means people can access officers easily and speak to someone face-to-face in confidence to get their problems resolved. Our officers and those from a wide variety of city organisations are here to offer people support. The message of Help at the Hub is, whatever your worry, don't face it on your own. Come along and get some friendly help and support. Residents do not have to book an appointment, but are asked to please be prepared to wait if the event is busy.
Up next, we have the Beacon Update, brought to us by Mohammed.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Beacon Update. My name is Mohammed, and I've got the latest for you from everything that's been happening here at Beacon. We're proud to launch the Beacon Strategy for 2025 to 2030. Bigger, bolder, brighter. Our plan to shape a more inclusive future for people living with sight loss. This strategy sets out how we will champion the following. 1. Eye health for all. 2. Accessible health pathways. 3. True inclusivity. 4. Support systems that work for our communities. Built with the voices of lived experience, it's all about empowering people to live confidently and independently. And we've made it available in a range of accessible formats, with a text-only version, an audio version, Braille, which is available on request. You can download it now on our website, www.beaconvision.org/beacon-strategy. Next up, looking for good company and friendly chats and a space where everyone gets it, our VIP groups are here for you. Whether you're in Dudley, Hales Owen, Sedgley, Kings Winford, or Stourbridge, there's a warm welcome waiting for you. Each group is a relaxed social space where people living with sight loss can connect, share, and have a laugh over a cuppa. Some even include gentle movement and well-being activities to lift your spirits and keep you feeling great. Come along and see what we are all about. Find out more on our website, www.beaconvision.org/community, because no one should face sight loss alone, and at Beacon, you don't have to. School's out and the fun's in. Come along to our relaxed holiday club, packed with games, laughs, and good times for children and young people with sight loss and their families. Think fun, friendly vibes in a chilled space where everyone's welcome, parents, carers, and siblings. Cherry Street, Send and Sensory Hub, Wolverhampton, Tuesday the 26th of August, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Totally free. Let's make summer magic happen. Email inquiries at beaconvision.org or call us on 01902880111 to book your place. A big thank you to Dormston School for supporting Beacon Centre for the Blind. As part of their fundraising challenge, students collected £31.40 in loose change, proving every penny really does count. Your efforts help us continue to support local people living with sight loss. Thank you for backing your local sight loss charity. We're looking for 30 people to help shape the next 150 years. Could one of them be you? To celebrate Beacon's 150th anniversary, we're asking 30 supporters to give just £5 a month. Why? Because together, that's £150 a month, enough to fund 11 hours of vital reception support. A team who have already helped almost 70 people take the first step on their sight loss journeys since April. It's a small commitment that makes a big difference. Sign up in August and you'll receive a personalized thank you card, a limited edition Beacon 150th pin badge, a £10 charity shop voucher, valid for 3 months. Let's do something brilliant together. Become one of our 30 supporters. Sign up at www.beaconvision.org/donations/donation-form. Over a week on, and we're still celebrating the Lionesses' incredible Euro 2025 victory. What a performance from the whole team. We want to give a special mention to goalkeeper Hannah Hampton, who hails from Birmingham and the Black Country. Her story is truly inspiring, as she overcame a sight condition called strabismus. Doctors once told her it would stop her from becoming a professional footballer, but she proved them wrong and played a key role in England's win. It's a powerful reminder that a sight condition doesn't have to be a barrier to achieving your dreams. Well done, Hannah, and the rest of the Lionesses. Finally this week, Don't forget to book your free tickets for Paddington in Peru, our special relaxed, accessible cinema experience for children living with sight loss is coming up on Tuesday, the 27th of August, and spaces are filling up fast. Join us for a fantastic afternoon with Paddington Bear, complete with audio description to make sure everyone can enjoy the adventure. Parents, siblings, and carers are all welcome. Plus, we'll even provide the snacks. Date, Tuesday, the 27th of August, 2025. Film starts at 1 p.m. Location, Beacon Centre, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. Secure your spot today by calling us on 01902 880111 or by emailing us at inquiries@beaconvision.org. That's it for this week's Beacon Update. Join me again next week where I will be bringing you even more from everything that's been happening at Beacon.
Thanks for that update, Mohammed. Next up, we have another block of local news. And up first, we hear from Christine.
The Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust has announced the potential relocation of its Colway Road surgery on Colway Road, Wolverhampton. It would see the service relocate to Warstone Health Centre on Pinfold Grove, 0.7 miles away. The proposed move is due to the Colway Road address needing significant work and the potential for better services at the new location. Around 4,726 patients are set to be affected by the potential move, but the Trust has said the Warstone site will offer improved disabled services such as dedicated parking bays and disabled toilets. A public meeting will take place at the Colway Road Surgery at 5 p.m. on Monday, August the 18th, where current patients and members of the community can get more information and raise their concerns. Laura Harper, Group Manager for the Trust's Primary Care Network, said, "We want to provide our communities with improved services from a location that is better equipped for providing modern healthcare and are keen to hear their views. The proposed move would not affect access to appointments as total triage, which ensures patients requiring same-day appointments are prioritised by our GPs, would still be in place. There would also be no reduction in the number of healthcare professionals available to meet our patients' needs. As well as dedicated disabled parking bays and disabled toilets, the Warstone site also offers hearing loops, entrance ramps, and phlebotomy and anticoagulant services on site. The group has said that the current team at the Colway Road Surgery would also relocate to the Warstones Health Centre so patients can still see familiar faces when they attend their appointments. A survey is currently underway. Patients can weigh in on the potential relocation here. Now, a drive to online services at GP surgeries can leave visually impaired, disabled or elderly patients out in the cold. With thanks to TNF Soundings contributors Heather and Vivian, we can now find out about new national advice and tips on how GPs should make sure everyone has fair access.
Hi, this is Viv, and I'm reading an article on helping GPs offer non-digital services. It sometimes seems that the world is rushing headlong into the digital age without remembering that some people have difficulty accessing information online. The move to online everything can be a problem for some visually impaired, disabled or elderly people who don't have the skills or technology to access online services or who simply prefer to talk to someone about their requirements. With cost savings taking an ever higher profile in the NHS and GP surgeries, the move towards online access is ramping up all the time. But in some cases, the move online, in pursuit of improved efficiency, and reduced costs can leave visually impaired, disabled and older people out of the loop. Whether it is help with medical appointments or prescriptions, the online world can be daunting or difficult to navigate for many. If you or someone you know falls into this category, you'll be pleased to hear about new advice for GP surgeries, explaining that they must offer non-digital access for patients in addition to their online services. The advice has been published by the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission. That's the EHRC for short. So, what does it all mean? The EHRC are concerned that digital-only services exclude some patients. They argue digitalisation risks making essential services more difficult to access for some patients, and this could lead to adverse consequences for their health. EHRC's new advice explains that GPs in England and Wales have a public sector equality duty and, as part of that, GP surgeries need to make sure that none of their patients are disadvantaged by the move to online services. In order for GP surgeries to deliver good, inclusive care, the EHRC's advice note makes it clear that digital services must be easily accessible, with alternative routes also available. EHRC also sets out steps for GP surgeries to make sure they consider all patients' needs. These could include, for example, setting up a VI/disabled patients user group to gather their views and understand their needs for communication and access to services, assessing all surgery processes to make sure they are accessible by patients who cannot or prefer not to use online services. Launching the advice, EHRC Chairwoman Baroness Kishwa Faulkner said, NHS general practices provide vital services to the communities they serve. It is concerning that recent reports show digitalisation can prevent some patients from seeking help when they need it most. Digitalisation can increase service quality and efficiency of services, but not everyone will be able to access them. Practices must act to identify and address barriers which might otherwise stop certain groups accessing essential services. She says the new advice will help GPs to understand the potential impact of their policies on people with specific needs, and where GPs do not comply with their duty to give everyone equal access, the EHRC will take action, added Baroness Faulkner.
TNF Soundings.
Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition.
Hello and welcome to this week's flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, these are your questions. Here we go. Question 1. What facial features is missing from the Mona Lisa? Question 2. Which book is stolen from the libraries the most? Question 3. How many sick sheep did the sick sheik have? Question 4. What animal cannot jump? Question 5. Who patented a paper bag making machine in 1871? And finally, question 6. What did Stephanie Kubelik discover in 1966? I will be back with you later in the show to give you all your answers, but for now, best of luck!
Cheers for those questions, Mina. I'll get my mind working on them. Up now, however, is another block of local news.
Now then, time to step out of the Black Country for a moment. As if you've by any chance got a summer holiday planned for the pretty, coastal, picture-perfect splendour of Cornwall this year, then how about adding this adventure to your itinerary? A specialist search and rescue team are looking for volunteer hiders to help train their dogs. Cornwall Search Dogs needs people to hide in fields, woodlands and on moors so the canine detectives can practice scenting and training them. Trustee and dog handler Annie Page said the team currently has 5 volunteers but would ideally like 15 across Cornwall. In the last 5 years, the charity near Camborne has had 240 call-outs, some of which were to help search for missing people, with the majority to find lost dogs. Ms. Page said the team was currently working with 11 dogs and trained near Bodmin, Penzance, Launceston and St Austell. She said, "It's always really nice to have new people to look for. The dogs get quite used to us lot going missing, and I think they probably think we're half daft because we always seem to go missing. It's really lovely to have new scents for our dogs to find," she added. "It's really having people who are enthusiastic and would love to come and meet the dogs and be part of our training group," she said. Fellow trustee and dog handler Tracy Simpson has Springer Spaniels Holly and Frida, who are part of the search team, which she said gets called out about 50 times a year. She said, "You're doing what the dog does naturally, so the dog naturally likes to hunt and look for things, and all you're doing is going along for the journey. On some occasions, definitely, if we hadn't gone out with our dogs, they would never have found their dog, and I think that's really humbling. It's an amazing experience to give back to the community like that. You've achieved something amazing with your dog." The team is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with its nighttime work focused on more vulnerable pets, such as puppies. The team has encouraged anyone wishing to help them train the dogs by acting as missing people to get in touch. Ms. Page, who handles Lila, a black Labrador, said, "The dogs love finding new people, and you get all the cuddles as well." Ms. Simpson added, "You don't need to like the people, but you surely need to like the dogs." Staying with our four-legged friends, we head back closer to home and to the University of Wolverhampton. When Caitlin Lee graduated with a bachelor's degree in sport and exercise therapy as one of the University of Wolverhampton's 2025 summer graduates last week, she didn't walk the stage alone. She proudly walked across the stage with her devoted guide dog, Honey, who had sat with her through each lecture, seminar, and practical session of her 3-year academic journey. Caitlin, who is visually impaired, overcame significant challenges to complete her qualification. Her success a testament not only to her determination, but to the unwavering loyalty of her four-legged friend. Talking about her academic experience alongside her lifelong friend, Caitlin said, "Honey was more than a guide. She was my independence, my confidence, and my calm. I couldn't have done this without her." In her graduation video, Caitlin could be seen donning her cap and gown, taking to the stage and proudly striding ahead as she collected her degree before being congratulated by her peers. She wasn't the only one dressed for the occasion. Honey had a gown of her own, handcrafted by Caitlin's lecturer, Aisha James Smith. The pup could be seen excitedly strutting along the stage with her owner as she donned her own graduation regalia, receiving plenty of pets on the way. Teresa Graham, assistant faculty registrar at the University of Wolverhampton, said, "Caitlin's story embodies the resilience, compassion and community spirit we're proud to foster at Wolverhampton. We're honoured to support her in giving back to the organisation that made her journey possible. To anyone facing challenges, don't let anything stop you. The university supported me every step of the way and they'll support you too. You are capable of more than you know." Now then, many of us are in awe of just how much guide dogs help their owners, But how exactly do you go about training one? Well, with thanks to Marley from St Albans and District Talking News Service, we get a lowdown from Charlotte Barrett, who is a full-time dog trainer with the charity Guide Dogs, and a few extra tips for ordinary dog owners too.
And now we have an interview with Charlotte Barrett from the Guide Dogs Association. The Guide Dogs story started in 1931 with two amazing British pioneers, Muriel Crook and Rosamund Bond. These remarkable women organised the training of the first four British guide dogs from a humble lock-up garage in Wallasey, Merseyside. They've come a very long way since those early days. Today, Guide Dogs is the world's largest breeder and trainer of working dogs. And thanks to the dedicated staff and volunteers and donations, 36,000 lives have been transformed through a guide dog partnership since 1931. And in the studio with us this afternoon is Charlotte Barrett from the Guide Dogs Association. Welcome, Charlotte.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very, very welcome. And thank you for coming in on this very grey and drizzly afternoon. So, Charlotte, can you give me some background?
Of course. So, Guide Dogs is a charity that specialises in providing mobility services for people with sight loss. We are, of course, most famous for our dogs, but we also provide other services like long cane training or rehabilitation services and assistance for children with sight loss with daily living skills and things like that. So we cover quite a broad range of things past the dogs that we are most famous for.
Yes, absolutely. So tell me about your route into guide dogs.
So I have a long history with guide dogs. I come from a family of guide dog owners. So I've always been very aware of the work that guide dogs do, and they had a really big impact on my growing up. So when it came to sort of choosing a career, it was always something in the back of my mind that I thought I might be good at with the experience that I came with. So I worked a bit on getting some dog experience through things like working in rescue, and then ended up here. So it was quite a challenge to get into guide dogs, I will say. It's
competitive, is it?
I find it to be, yes. It took quite a few attempts to get an interview, but I'm really glad I persisted because they've been wonderful to work for.
So that's where you are now. You're a trainer.
Yeah.
So this must be the most fun job in the world, mustn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It really is a wonderful job. Very, very rewarding. It's very fun, you know, and every day is so different, and every dog is different that comes through. So yeah, it's a really varied and interesting job to have.
Where do the puppies come from?
Oh, good question. So the sort of lifespan of the dog would be they are born to one of our breeding dogs. They are usually born at the breeding dog volunteer's house. It's a bit nicer for mum to be in a familiar space. Sometimes that doesn't work out with health and things like that. So they might be born at the vets or at our breeding centre in Leamington. The dogs will stay with mum until they are about 8 weeks old, and then they will go to a volunteer puppy raiser where they will stay and learn all the basics and all their manners. And there's so many
things.
House training, absolutely. That's a big one. So many things that the puppy raisers do for our dogs. They really are wonderful, and they dedicate so much of their time to raising our dogs.
And these are volunteers?
They are all volunteers, yes.
Wow.
They are wonderful. So they'll stay with the puppy raisers until they're about 14 months old,
right.
And then they will come to a training site, so like the one we have in St Albans. They'll come to a trainer like me, and then they'll stay with us doing all the training for about 6 months, depends on the dog, up until the point where they can be matched with a guide dog owner.
So it's only 6 months. I thought the process would be longer for some reason. So it's quite intense, I imagine.
It is quite intense, and different dogs will cope with the training in different ways. It's very rare that a dog will go all the way through training without some sort of issue that we have to work on, and that can delay things somewhat. So as long as a dog is making decent progress, we will usually just give the dog as long as it needs. So I've had dogs in training for over a year who have gone on to make it. It really is dependent on the dog.
What's the sort of ratio of dogs that do and don't?
Roughly, I think we're about 60% success at the moment.
It's quite high, isn't it?
It is quite high. And this, it does depend on different breeds that we use have different success rates. Our Labrador cross Golden Retrievers are the most successful. And then it's our Labradors and then our Golden Retrievers. The German Shepherd cross Golden Retrievers, they can be a little bit less successful. But
what typically goes wrong?
There are so many things that a dog can get withdrawn on in the training. I think the most common, I would say, is probably things like high distraction. If we're discounting health, our Labradors can be a bit prone to hip dysplasia and things like that. So if we discount health, it's usually high distraction. Things like a lack of adaptability can be a reason for withdrawal, or low confidence. You know, our dogs, they need to be adaptable in a variety of situations. They need to have the confidence to step out in front of their guide dog owner, to assess situations as they come to them, and to be able to make safe decisions in that moment. And we need to be sure that if this dog encounters something that they're not sure about, that they aren't going to do something unsafe, like jump into the road or
chase something.
Absolutely. Yes. Squirrels are a big one for that. So those are reasons why our dogs can be withdrawn.
Now, tell me, Charlotte, my dog has a terrible sort of prey drive. What do you do training wise to stop them dashing off after a squirrel or a rabbit? I'm sure lots of listeners would want to know this too.
Oh, absolutely. So chase can be a really difficult thing to train out, especially with dogs that are sort of prone to it in their breed. So, for example, our German Shepherds have a really high prey drive, and they will not even stop to think when they see a squirrel. They will just go. What we would do is a lot of exposure work around squirrels or the thing that they were chasing. We would start off with a lot of distance, and we could be talking sort of one end of a park to the other, and we would stand with the dog and wait for a squirrel to appear, and we would reward anything that wasn't a movement towards the squirrel. So that might be just standing and watching. You would reward that. That's what you want. Anything that approximates the end behavior, which is being able to ignore the distraction in the environment. So this can be a really long process, you know.
I was thinking that it must be, because, you know, most dogs, and dogs are dogs, they want to chase things. Reward standing still.
Yep.
So that's the first base, I guess, is it?
Absolutely. And then you have to play to the dog's strengths. So our Labradors, they love food reinforcement. So we would use food reinforcement as a first port of call for them. Our German Shepherds don't tend to be so into their food. So for a reward for them might be something like a toy, you know,
a squeaky toy or something.
Toy. It might be physical praise. It might be vocal praise. You have to really know the dogs before you even begin the distraction work. Yeah, that would be weeks and weeks of slowly decreasing the distance to the distraction. And only when you have a decent response with a close proximity to the distraction, you can start adding in things like moving, because moving is really difficult for a dog. They naturally, they want to move towards the distraction. You want them to move past the distraction. So it might even be a look. You would reward them just for a look in the right direction, and you would shape that slowly into looking, to stepping, to moving past. And then you can bring in them having to think about all the other things they have to do while they're working. So curbs, obstacles. It's quite involved for them to have to do.
You must have to have really a lot of patience.
Yes, absolutely. It can sometimes feel like you're just doing the same thing day in, day out. Yeah. But sometimes you have to take notes and then look back and think, oh, no, actually, I've actually come a bit further than, you know,
you're making progress. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be, you can lose that in the day to day. So, distraction is really tricky.
Yeah. So what other training techniques would you use? Obviously, distraction is a major one.
A fun one I can tell you about is locating objectives. So an objective is anything that the dog can target while they're working. So when I say target, I mean they can put their nose on it or put their face on it. Yeah. So we use a lot of things like find the chair, and that's got loads of applications, like doctor's surgeries where the guide dog owner might not know the layout.
Oh, I see.
You know, it's so much nicer being able to walk into somewhere like a doctor's surgery and immediately be able to locate the waiting room because the dog can find you a chair, or even just somewhere to sit and wait. You know, any sort of waiting room situation can also be used on trains, buses,
hospitals,
absolutely, cafes, although the dog doesn't usually understand that you have to look for an empty table, which can be a bit awkward.
I can imagine.
Yeah. But you know, that usually opens up to a point where you can find a seat somewhere.
That's such a helpful thing thing to do, isn't it? It's not just something that everyday sighted people take for granted. You walk into a room and you can sit down, but you can't with a visually impaired person.
It is really wonderful. It's a really fun one to teach because you can really get them to locate absolutely anything. And it's also a really good, the sort of locating objectives behaviour is really good for things like non-standard paving situations. So if you think of a pedestrianised open space, really, really difficult to navigate with sight loss. So what the dogs could do is locate an orientation marker for the guide dog owner. And this could be something like a postbox or a lamppost or a cash point or anything really where they can, you know, oh, the lamppost is here, so my left turn is in about 10 paces time. Stuff like that is... So when people stop me in the street and say, how does the dog know the way to the post office? I have to say, well, they don't. The guide dog owner knows the way to the post office and they direct the dog. But there is an element of being able to teach the dog certain markers on a route.
And do they use their sense of smell? Because obviously certain places smell in certain ways.
Normally when the dog's using their nose on a route, it's because they're being a bit cheeky. we try and minimise sniffing with our dogs.
A dog's natural thing is to put the nose down and sniff everywhere else where dogs have peed before or any kind of scent that they like. So you try and just stop them doing that so they're less...
Yes, we do. And that's, I think, what makes guide dogs' job so much more difficult than lots of other service dogs, because most of the service dogs, you're using their natural instincts to benefit the job they're doing. Mm. So sniffer dogs, they love to sniff, and search and rescue, they love to find stuff. But guide dogs, Labradors love to sniff, but we have to discourage that in our training. So this is why our dropout rate is quite a bit higher maybe than some other organisations. It's because in a way we're going against their natural instinct.
Totally, in lots of ways. I mean, not being able to chase, not being able to sniff, that's the two things my dog does all the time. It takes up her whole life.
Completely. So, but we do sort of mitigate this in making allowances for the dog sometimes. And we're bringing that in a lot at the moment with things like giving them sniffing breaks, not expecting them to have to do an entire day's work and not having anything for themselves.
It's like having a coffee break at work, isn't it?
Yeah, they get to go, oh, okay, wow, that was hard work that I just did, but at least I get to sniff this really sniffy bit of grass.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a little play break or something like that, a bit of downtime for them.
So my big question is, and as a dog owner, how do you let them go when you've spent all that time training with them? And it must be a tough one. Every few months, you've got to let another one go.
It is really difficult. And some really stick with you. You know, after 5 years now, I've got quite used to it. You know, every 6 months, there's a bit of heartbreak and I have a sad day and then I move on. But the ones where you've really had to work to iron out some issues and they've gone on to make successful guides, I think that those are the most difficult ones to let go of.
Because you put so much time and effort into it, and I suppose they have too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you form this really close bond with them, especially when you have these difficult issues to work through. So those ones can be a bit tricky, but you get used to it, as sad as that sounds. Mm. It becomes a bit of a regular occurrence if you're in this job. It is nice with the qualified dogs that they're still out there. You know, as a trainer, we don't go back to see them, but our colleagues who are mobility specialists do. And you often get, you know, oh, I went to see such and such with your dog, and you get a little update on them. And
that's nice.
That's
isn't it?
Really sweet. Yeah,
especially if they're doing well and they've settled.
Yeah.
Is there a handover process with the visually impaired person? Is there any training you have to do with them when they accept their guide dog? So
yeah. So when I hand over a dog to, we call it going on class, the dog gets matched with their guide dog owner. They will often have, well, they'll start off with a matching walk where it's established if the speed, the tension is a good match, the personality of the dog sometimes.
Of course.
The abilities of the dog, the abilities of the person, that will all be tested. And if the person on the list agrees with the mobility specialist that it's a good match, it'll go ahead. Then there'll often be an overnight stay to test the home behaviour, how the dog settles in, especially if there are things like children in the home, other dogs, cats, that's a big one.
Yep. Can imagine.
And then if all is well on the overnight stay, they'll begin class, which is generally 2 weeks in a hotel, just the guide dog owner and the dog in the hotel room, which allows time for bonding between the two and sort of takes the guide dog owner away from the daily stresses of life. But it's time specifically put aside for training just that partnership. So they'll have their 2 weeks in the hotel doing routes around the hotel, and then they'll go home for and do 3 further weeks of training doing their home routes. And then by that time, either they'll qualify, or if they need a bit more time, that's fine. What I would say about all of the people that I've worked with, they are so dedicated to making that match work. You know, it's not easy in the early days. Mm. You know,
tell us about the dogs that don't make the training process.
So the dogs that don't make it will be considered for our buddy dog scheme, which is a wonderful scheme that we run, which provides a dog to a family who have a child with sight loss. And the dog doesn't do any guiding, but they exist as a sort of support dog for the child.
Like a companion. Yeah,
absolutely. And they can, if the child is interested in becoming a guide dog owner further down the line, it's a really nice introduction to what's involved with looking after a dog, the experience of having a dog in the home, how much is involved in the care, the feeding. So that is what will be considered first off if a dog doesn't make it. If they're not suitable for buddy, they will go out to rehoming. So we have, I think it's about 3,000 people on our waiting list to rehome. Normally, it's quite a quick process to match them with someone on our rehoming list. And then they go out just to be essentially really nice pets, but maybe with quirks that don't quite align with the guiding role.
So that brings on the organisation itself, which I guess is a charity. Mm. You have to raise funds all the time.
There's loads of different ways we fundraise. We don't get any funding from anywhere that isn't the public. We have our sponsor a puppy scheme, which is really popular. I can't remember off the top of my head how much it is that you pay, but a certain amount per month, and then you get updates on the pup as they move through training. You get sort of videos of their training and when they, you know, little certificates when they make it and things like that. That's a really sweet one. We also have things like our raffle, which is nice, a little bit less involved. There are options on our website if anyone would like to donate. That's not the reason why I'm here. I just love talking about my job. But if anyone would like to donate, there are loads of ways to do that on the website, which should be fully accessible with screen readers, I should say.
Absolutely. That's very important. Mm. And if somebody listening wanted to volunteer in any way, how can you get involved volunteer-wise?
Ooh, we are really short of puppy raises at the moment, but that's pretty much the biggest commitment to us that anyone could make. And it's a lot of work. There are often opportunities for volunteer roles regarding looking after the dogs, whether that's respite care for maybe dogs that are qualified. If the guide dog owner, say, needs to go to hospital, there's somewhere for that dog to go. We have volunteer fosterers who look after the dogs on a daily basis. It's almost like school hours. They spend in the office with us, and then our volunteer fosterers have them evenings and weekends. It's really nice. We have lots of families who look after our dog. Again, like you were saying with the sadness when the dogs move on, there are a lot of tears from,
I can imagine,
the whole family when they give the dog back. And it is, you know, they know what they're signing up for.
Yes.
But it doesn't make it any easier a lot of the time. There's often another one just around the corner, so that can
get
help.
A new puppy.
Yeah.
Well, that is so fascinating, Charlotte. Thank you so much for coming in. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
If you want to know more about the Guide Dogs organisation, as Charlotte mentioned in the interview, their website is totally accessible to all and you can reach it on guidedogs.org.uk. Worth a visit, I think.
DNF Soundings.
Up next, let's have another Beacon update.
Here's something of special interest if you were a fan of Wolves or West Brom. Well, with the new football season fast approaching, our Talking News service would like to hear from you. In an exciting new development to the weekly football roundup, our Fan Zone feature will give you the opportunity to leave your thoughts, opinions and reaction to all the action from the weekend, making you the stars of the show. So, whether you are part of the Wolves pack, a boing boing baggy, or just a fervent follower of the beautiful game, if you'd like to be one of our prize pundits, then please do get in touch to register your interest. You can call, drop a text message, or leave a WhatsApp voice note with your name and who you support with our Talking News team on 07849 802 703. We can't wait to hear from you. It's going to be truly phenomenal.
Up next, it's trivia time, brought to us by Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. It's all yours, Roger. Take it away.
Hello again, everyone. I do hope that you're all well and raring to hear this week's rash of data that I've unearthed for you all. I've also sprinkled in some favourites of mine that I hope you don't mind hearing again. So here we go. Now then, did you know that? The Mona Lisa has no eyebrows. Some say that there once were, but they'd faded or painted over, or that they were inadvertently removed during cleaning. It's just one of the many mysteries surrounding this enigmatic artwork. Mind you, nobody had speculated that maybe she had just had a very heavy plucking session. And the most stolen book from public libraries is the Guinness Book of Records. So therefore, it holds the record for being the most often stolen tome. I do hope that they have issued a certificate to themselves though, as they do for the other world records. Now then, here's a corker that I couldn't help repeating for us. So how about this conundrum? The six sheep sick is said to be the toughest tongue twister in the English language. I'll say it again slowly, word by word, so that you can practice. The sixth sheep's sick. Got it? Good, because I haven't. And elephants are the only animals that can't jump. The bones in their legs all point downwards and don't have the necessary spring to allow them to leap. Most animals that jump can do so as a technique to avoid predators, and jumping isn't something elephants need to do to avoid such natural danger. And inventor Margaret Knight had her invention stolen by a man who claimed that there was no way a woman could have invented such a machine. She finally received a patent for it in 1871 for a machine that could produce the square-bottomed paper bags that we use and never think twice about. And then another lady inventor, Stephanie Kwolek, in 1966, who while searching for strong but lightweight plastics to use in car tyres, DuPont researcher Stephanie Kwolek discovered what would become known as Kevlar. This revolutionary fiber has saved countless lives in the form of bulletproof vests and is also used in numerous applications such as bridge cables, canoes, and frying pans. Well, that's a mixed bag of conversation stoppers to add to your repertoire this week, and I hope that you'll practice the tongue twister for your party piece. But for me, well, guess what? My new kettle's about to boil. It's a whistling one, so I hope it won't get on my nerves after a while. Never mind, eh? I'll just enjoy me chocky cake and a nice cup of tea. Till next time, then, I'll just say bye for now. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra.
Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
Hi everyone, it's Mina here with your forecast for the week ahead. I hope you all been enjoying the cooler and little more comfortable days of weather this week. With the weather map set to turn red again, things are set to heat up as we move into next week. The higher UV levels shall return, so do take care and continue taking the necessary precautions as the prolonged sunshine should see UV levels peak to high this week. The sunrise and sunset times are 5:45 a.m. for the sunrise and 8:40 p.m. for the sunset. As for the weather, Friday 8th of August is looking like it will see the last of the current unsettled weather, with light rain showers and sunshine expected throughout the day. With a moderate breeze, temperatures shall be pleasant at 22 degrees. Moving into the weekend, and the breeze shall ease to a gentle westerly, giving us long, dry and warm spells of sunshine, with temperatures climbing to 24 degrees for both Saturday 9th and Sunday 10th of August. Moving into next week, and it's remaining just as bright and cheery, with plenty of unbroken sunshine forecast to continue right through the week from Monday the 11th of August to Thursday 14th of August. Temperatures will sizzle at a high of 25 degrees across the week, The gentle breeze coming in from the north may provide some pleasant and refreshing relief. So it does look like we are set for another week of summer sunshine. Do take care and have a wonderful week. Enjoy the weather.
Up next, let's have another block of local news.
A mystery surrounding a 70-year-old letter found under a tree at a house in Wolverhampton may have been solved after relatives of the man it was addressed to came forward. The letter, dated January 1955, was sent from a hotel in Torquay, Devon, to a J.R. Gwilt at Stafford Road in Fordhouses, setting out the costs of its rooms, and was recently uncovered by a gardener doing some clearing up at a nearby house. Carol Griffiths, a niece of Mr. Gwilt, said she knew her uncle got married in April that year and the letter would have been him planning his honeymoon. She said her uncle lived in the house it was found at before his death about 10 years ago and said it was exciting to come across it. He's John Raymond Gwilt and his wife was Barbara, she said. The letter is definitely him inquiring about his honeymoon as they went to Torquay a lot, especially when he was a kid. They always went there and loved it. Gardener Adam Elshaw said he was working in the garden a few weeks ago when he found the letter, and he said the current homeowners knew nothing about it. The typed letter is from a hotel called Ashley Court in Torquay and is responding to an inquiry by Mr. Gwilt about a possible booking. The letter stated, rooms were charged at 6, 7, and 7.5 guineas per person for a week. About £140 nowadays, including meals. Mrs. Griffiths from Shifnal in Shropshire said, as the couple married in April of 1955, as soon as I read it, we knew it would be for their honeymoon. Her uncle had lived at Stafford Road, where his family ran a butcher's shop, before moving to Woodthorne Road in Tettenhall, where the letter was found. It was quite a shock to see it, she said. It's been quite exciting, really, and we were saying how weird it is. We've all been talking about it, and it's a small world, as some people I know through a church I go to knew of Adam who found the letter, so we've been in touch and talking about it. As to how the letter ended up outside, Mrs. Griffiths said she believes it was down to the new owners of the house. Mr. Gwilt died about 10 years ago, and his wife Barbara died 3 years ago, and the family sold the house within the past 12 months. Mrs. Griffiths said she expected the owners were clearing the house out and it fell out and ended up under a tree at the front of the property, where it lay until Mr. Elshaw discovered it. Mr. Gwilt's son, David, said he and his sister Jane were very grateful to Mr. Elshaw for his diligence and interest. The letter meant an awful lot to us, he added. Now then, staying in the garden, and there's more to garden design than just pretty flowers. With thanks to TNF Soundings contributors Lindsay and Amanda, as well as permission granted by the charity Vocal Eyes and the BBC for use of audio description from a visit to Chelsea Psychic Garden, the following article looks at how choosing the right mix of features and plants can make garden visits a great sensory experience for people with visual impairments or other disabilities.
Hello, I am Amanda, reading this article written by Lindsay, and it is called Talking Sense About Garden Design. Most people will have heard of the world-famous Chelsea Flower Show, held annually in London. While you might think the gardens there are beyond your abilities, some of the modern concepts of sensory garden design embodied at Chelsea have been creeping into everyday gardens, a bit like a rampant yet fragrantly sweet honeysuckle. This is particularly true of the sensory garden ideals of layouts that mix open and enclosed cozy spaces with different cognitive purposes. For example, textured structures like wooden benches or stone walls to ground the sitter, and gentle flowing water features or invigorating fountains to give the impression of countryside or urban areas. Planting contrasting flower colour choices together helps create a visual statement piece, and of course, heavily scented plants to evoke pleasant memories along with perhaps very tactile leaves reaching out for hands-on therapeutic comfort to all. Certain trees and bushes, like bamboo, can also shield gardens from distracting and unwanted urban noises, bringing a sense of peace to that pocket of nature. Every bit of nature has a purpose, none so obvious as plants either attracting pollinators or people, and bringing proven health and well-being benefits through the senses to put the mind in neutral. This is especially useful if living with challenges such as disability, mental stress, visual impairment, or total sight loss. Fortunately, in the UK there are several public gardens that offer sensory experiences for those who do not have their own garden or simply wish to expand their botanical knowledge. Most follow a conventional format of guided tours, allowing visitors to smell the scent of various plants and enable touching of safe plants with either furry, fluffy, or even sticky surfaces. However, there are a few which are going that extra mile and trying to engage the visitor's senses in a different and somewhat original way. Kew Royal Botanic Gardens, London, are not only smelling the roses, they are probably eating them as well. They boast seasonal food, which has been foraged directly from their gardens, and transform the produce into seasonal dishes for their restaurant and cafes on site, hoping to delight the visitors' taste buds. Literally sticking with the more adventurous themes, Trentham Gardens, Staffordshire, offers a unique barefoot walk to feel the sensations on the feet while walking over different surfaces, such as mud, pebbles, grass, and textured bark. There is the bonus sensation of rinsing your feet off in the nearby babbling brook afterwards. And for those who prefer quieter strolls, there is the Royal Botanic Garden, Edinburgh. In their affiliated site at Doic Botanic Garden near Peebles, they utilise a garden guide who is visually impaired aware to lead sensory treat weekends. The tour manages to combine learning about garden history, plant collections, and modern paintings, all whilst visitors walk and get hands-on with various selected plants. In fact, enhancing and navigating different and unfamiliar environments is where location audio description can help. Vocal Eyes Charity created an audio-described tour of Chelsea Physic Garden in London as part of their ongoing mission to provide visitors the best opportunities to enjoy public spaces such as art venues and heritage sites through adding audio description for those with sight loss. You can find out more about Vocal Eyes and hear more of their audio descriptions on their website, vocaleyes.co.uk. And to spell that out for you, that's vocaleyes.co.uk. And here, demonstrating the benefits of location audio commentary with kind permission from Vocal Eyes, is their walkthrough tour of Chelsea Physic Garden.
As you make your way down the path, there is a wonderful plant that I want to just give you an idea of what's in front of you. It's twice as tall as I am. I'm 5'4", and it's twice as tall as I am. It's called an echium, and it has slender pendulous green leaves. They have points at the tip and they're covered in tiny little hairs, and there is an enormous spike, almost like a spire of a cathedral, of pale blue flowers, little clusters of pale blue flowers, and the bees are loving it. So at the bottom you've got the stem. I don't know if, Tony, if you'd like to touch the stem. It does have hairs on it.
Okay.
So don't be surprised if you find hairs.
Are there bees in there, is
there are no bees at the bottom.
Right, okay.
But I will let you know if there's bees in the top.
Oh.
I did warn you, there are hairs on it.
Yeah, well, actually, it's sort of, to the touch, it's quite prickly, but the prickles are very close together, and it's actually kind of furry, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. It's almost like a fur coat, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't want to first
touch that. Ow! I rubbed it up the wrong way.
This section was just opened 1 week ago. These have got various different themes. the main one with this lot are either edible or with one of the beds, which is our brewing bed or our booze bed or our distillation bed, are drinkable plants.
Can I volunteer to try out the booze bed?
Yes, you can be the first to try. On the booze bed, we have winter wheat, which some vodkas are made out of. This is the winter wheat. And then we've got apples for cider, we've got maize because it's distilled, we've got potatoes for vodka, we've got a juniper tree which is for gin.
The leaves are long and spiky, and then you've got these bright green fronds that are up from the ears of the wheat. You can feel the ears in between.
It just amazes me how that turns into vodka.
We're heading across now to the rock garden and a statue of Sir Hans Sloane, who is a very important character in the garden. I'll just give you an idea of what he's like. He's life-size. He's dressed in the robes of an 18th century gentleman, so he's got a long curled wig. He's wearing a long robe, and underneath that, he's got a short knee-length frock coat and he's wearing knee breeches and stockings.
And Hans Sloane, is he anything to do with Sloane Square?
He is indeed, yeah. There are various places around this area named after him. He basically, at one point in his life, owned Chelsea, so he was our landlord. He studied here and he loved the garden. He would have studied medicine here. And when he became landlord of the garden and owned Chelsea, which is a good job if you can get it, he made sure that as long as we teach about useful plants, then our ground rent on this 3.5-4 acres, 1.5 hectares of land will only be £5 per year forever. And some of the houses that you would have passed on your way into the garden, 7-bedroom houses with 3 reception rooms, swimming pool on the 5th floor, roof terraces and large gardens. Some of the rent they're looking for one of these is £24,000 per week. So £5 a year is an absolute bargain. So we're thankful to him, hence the statue.
We're just by the cork tree, which has a very thick, wrinkled, greyish brown bark. It's about 30 foot tall and the leaves are actually quite small oval leaves with slight point to them hanging above us. Michael.
Yeah, so this cork tree is a type of oak. It's a Portuguese oak. It's an evergreen. And the cork itself, which is a very useful insulating material, is on the tree to protect it from forest fires.
How does this grow in this climate?
Because we have these quite tall buildings on 3 sides of the garden, they radiate heat back into the garden in the wintertime. So it has its mini microclimate, which is maybe in the depths of winter a few degrees warmer than it would have been in a more exposed site. We have a couple of oddities. One of them is in the corner that most people don't get to see, is a grapefruit tree that's just in the corner, which always has fruit on it.
Is that very unusual to have a grapefruit tree?
I think it's the most northerly growing grapefruit tree outdoors with fruit on in the world, yeah.
Wow.
It's just because it's in a nice protected, sheltered spot. Occasionally in the wintertime, from about November through to about April, the gardeners do have to wrap up some of the plants. And one of the ones just behind Roz to the right of some of you, there's one that's just got a few leaves back on it. It's looking quite twiggy. That has a little mini greenhouse built around it, made out of bubble wrap every winter. And that's from some parts of Asia, which probably doesn't really like our winters at all, especially this last winter.
Oh, right.
There are needles all around, so do be careful. And it's got little buds at the top, which again, they've got a spike. I just got a spike in my finger.
Oh, dear. So let's be careful.
Michael, what's this we've got here?
The cucumber family gives us lots of things like melons and pumpkins, but it also gives us gourds. And in many parts of the world, gourds are hollowed out and they're used for carrying water and for the kind of the resonant bowls for different musical instruments. And this is one, I don't even know the name of this instrument, but it's like a thumb harp. And it's got metal bits that can be plucked.
Oh, wow. What? Any requests?
Yeah. Maybe it's
because
I'm a Londoner.
Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner. No, I can't quite get the notes.
It's more like... That's it.
I thought you was away there, Michael.
DNF Soundings.
Now, here come the quiz
answers.
And they're brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Feeling confident? How will you score? Let's see. Question 1. What facial feature is missing on the Mona Lisa? And the answer, her eyebrows. Question 2. Which book is stolen from libraries the most? And the answer here is the Guinness Book of Records. Question 3. How many sick sheep did the sick sheik have? And the answer is 6. Question 4. What animal cannot jump? And the answer here is the elephant. Question 5. Who patented a paper bag making machine in 1871? And the answer here is Margaret Knight. And finally, question 6. What did Stephanie Kulik discover in 1966? And the answer, Kevlar. Did you get them all right? If not, not to worry. I will be back next week to test you all once again. Bye for now.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!